welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my mother and co-host, Caroline Kilborn.
And hello, everyone. Another beautiful day here.
Yes, it is. It is. Fall, you know, we talk about how fall's really is what makes Iowa worthwhile. Fall and spring.
Yeah, right, exactly. Forget about winter.
Forget about winter. Summer can be pretty miserable, but fall and spring are pretty darn good.
So yeah, trees are getting gorgeous. So
of course now we talk about winter being challenging here, but
Why don't you introduce? Yes.
Why don't you introduce our author today?
Our author today is Laura Galloway, and she's a writer and communication strategist. She began her career at the Los Angeles Times and holds a Master of Arts in Indigenous Journalism from the, is that SAMI?
Yeah, that's right.
How do you pronounce that?
SAMI
University of thank you, of Applied Sciences in, okay, you could say that word.
Kautokeino.
There you go, Norway. A Bachelor of Arts in Political Science, my goodness, from University of Southern California. An ardent animal lover, she and her partner live with her two reindeer herding dogs and two cats. And the name of the book is Dalvi.
Yep.
Six years in the Arctic tundra. And that's cold, right?
So, welcome to Writer's Voices, Laura.
Thank you, Monica. Tell us a little bit
about what took you to the Arctic tundra.
Yes, well, I went to the Arctic because I first became connected to the Arctic because several years ago I took an early stage commercial DNA test that suggested that I might have some DNA connection to the Sami people, who are the indigenous inhabitants of Arctic Sweden, Norway, Finland, and the Kola Peninsula of Russia. And I was really intrigued by this because I had considered myself to be a global soul and a very well-traveled person, and I had never heard that there were indigenous people in Scandinavia. And so I started reading about them and looking into them, and eventually I made a trip to the Arctic and just absolutely loved it. I loved it because it was such a profound juxtaposition from the life that I was living in New York as a media executive with my own consultancy and some very big clients. And I just lived life at a 10,000 mile an hour pace in New York and was getting really kind of burnt out. So during my travels to the Arctic, eventually I met a reindeer herder, as one does if you are in the north of Norway, at a wedding, and we started a relationship. And,
one does obviously meet reindeer herders, of course.
And we started a long-distance relationship, and eventually, you know, things were really coming to a head in New York. I was really burning out on work. I'd lost a major client that was a big part of my identity. They wanted to go with a bigger firm. Things were coming to a head with my family, a very complicated family, and I just needed to do something different. And so the reindeer herder said, come live with me in Kautokeino. And I thought, you know, I'll go for a few months and see what it's, you know, what it's like. And I ended up living with the herder for 6 months, enrolling in Sami language school, because it's a completely different language. And in the dead of winter, that first winter, the reindeer herder left in the night. He broke up with me. And I was faced with the decision, do I stay in the Arctic or do I go? And I stayed for 6 years.
You know, All of that sounds like something I would not do. Except for taking the DNA test. I've done that.
Yes. Yeah.
The rest of it. So, you know, I mean, you're not talking about, you know, going like up to Vermont from New York for try it out for a few months. You can always go back. I mean, you just packed up everything, didn't you?
I did. Gave up your apartment and the whole bit.
So you were pretty committed when you went over there for with this guy that you. How much time had you spent with him before you went?
We were in an enormous amount of contact, so it wasn't a fly-by-night decision. And I would have gone to Norway anyway, I think, had he not – I was planning on doing that had he not said, come to Kautokeino. I had actually thought about going to another village called Karajok, which is very nearby. But he really pushed the idea along. And, yeah, so that's where I landed.
And you ended up doing a master's degree at the university there. And was that part of the plan all along, or was that – how did that come about?
I did that – I decided to do that a few years later because I felt like I had spent so much time in the North that it was really important for me to actually have some credential around it. And to really know more about, on an academic level, the culture I was living in, which I was living, and also because I am my profession is that I do communications, and I wanted to really focus on why so many indigenous issues do not make it on the news agenda, because there's so much happening. And so that was really the focus of my master's, which is in Sami journalism. But it was the first ever program taught in English. I was part of the first cohort, and it was really fascinating.
Wow. You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Laura Galloway, author of Dalvi, My 6 Years in the Arctic Tundra. Now, what does Dalvi mean?
Dalvi is the Sami word, the northern Sami word for winter.
Ah.
Okay, good to know.
Yeah. And why did you choose that as the title of the book?
For a few reasons. The first was that I felt like I'd spent so much time in this place that I really wanted to get a Sami word out into the wider culture in whatever way I could. And also because winter was such an important season in my life. You know, it's when my mother died when I was 3 and a half, which kind of set off a lifelong desire for connection and a sense of home and belonging. And winter was the toughest season to endure all those years in the Arctic. So it just felt like the appropriate title.
Wow. And you found a lot of friendly people there during those 6 years. Didn't you make a lot of friends there?
I did. It was really amazing that I was able to meet and make a lot of friendships, a lot of angels that kind of came into my orbit to help me along my way and for whom I'm forever grateful.
Did very many of the inhabitants of this little town, Kautokeino, speak English?
Yes, but I will say about Sami language, it's there are many dialects of Sami. I lived in a place that was northern Sami. You know, people think that Norway has one language and it's Norwegian, but the second official language of Norway is Sami language. And so people are speaking Sami and now, of course, if you go south to Bergen or Oslo or one of these places and you speak Sami, people will look at you like you're crazy because they won't know the language. But you get where I lived in the north, everything was in Norwegian or Sami language. That street signs, all of the schools in my village were primarily taught in Sami language. You could get your driver's license or your snowmobile license, you know, in Norway in Sami language. So there's been a real, real effort in Norway by way of reparations to help revitalize Sami language, because I think all the Scandinavian countries were really tough to the Samis.
Had they tried to wipe out the language at one point?
Yes. There was a huge period of time in Norway's history, a time in which something called Norwegianization happened. And I think this is the story with a lot of different indigenous groups. But in Norway, kids were sent to boarding schools where they were taught to assimilate. They could not speak Sami language. They were not allowed to speak their mother tongue. I mean, this is really the first way that you kind of deconstruct a culture is by taking away their language. And so there were major institutional efforts to homogenize the Sami within the larger community.
Wow. And when did that get reversed, start to be reversed?
I believe in the 1980s, it started to get, the policy was officially, very officially reversed. And so you saw a big kind of shift, and you started to see Sami people that were starting to protest and kind of stand up for their culture and have more of a voice, which was a really kind of a radical thing to do, because there was a long history of just not being able to do that at all, not to have your language or your culture. And you'll meet a lot of people that are in their 60s and 70s that that actually speak the language because they know the language, but didn't have formal education in writing the language or are learning it in school. So it's really amazing to see people going back to school who might not have the writing down.
So when you were studying the Sami language there, what other, you know, who else would come and study Sami at a university in this little town in the Arctic?
Well, I did it. I started because it was going to be the only way for me to communicate with my boyfriend's family or people or other reindeer herders, because English was spoken by some people, but I didn't speak Norwegian. So it's interesting because as part of the language revitalization, you'd see a lot of people coming, a lot of younger people coming to learn Sami formally. There are people that had academic jobs studying other indigenous groups. My closest friend in my language courses who suffered as much as I did because we just didn't speak Norwegian or Swedish. Those are the languages of instruction where we, was Japanese. And so she had one book that a Japanese scholar had written from Japanese to Sami, translating verbs. And I had to sit, I felt like an 8-year-old girl sitting next to her every day, peeking at her red book with the translations that were in English to Sami. But it took a Japanese person to do that. So
how in the world can you learn a language when the instruction is being taught in a language that you don't, another language that you don't know?
It's a great question, and it was really, really difficult. And I write about that in my book, that you can yell banana at me till kingdom come, and I'm not going to know what it is unless you hold up a banana. And I really struggled also because the books were, as I just said, were in Norwegian or in Swedish, and I didn't know those languages at the time. And you can't go to Google Translate or use any of these nifty translation things. So it was really a struggle. And I I'm a middle-aged woman. I was in my 40s when I was doing this, and I was never a brilliant language learner. And so it really created, my brain was stretched.
Now, I'm curious why you chose to study Sami rather than Norwegian, which would maybe have a wider application.
Because I was living in a place where Sami was the primary language.
Okay.
And it felt important also to just be supportive of the community in learning this language, or doing my best to learn it, because it was in a period of, you know, being revitalized. There are about 40,000 speakers of Northern Sami. And Norwegian is a much easier language to learn, actually, because many of the words you can pretty much figure out are similar to words in English. The structure can be the same. Some things are much easier in Norwegian than they are in English, even. So,
now, I have a very good friend. One of my business partners is, her parents were from Finland. She's Finnish. She said Finnish is like the second most difficult language in the world or something like that, but it's not similar to Norwegian at all, is it?
No, but Finnish, but Sami and Finnish are connected, as your friend probably told you.
Yeah. And she also was talking about culture, like kind of cultural differences in Finland. And I know that you ran into like making some cultural faux pas when you first, or things that the community did that you were culture shock for you. The one she mentioned, I think it was in a book of this guy who had gone to live in Finland many in I don't know 50 years ago or something, and they had an apartment and they didn't have a clothes dryer, and they strung a rope out to dry their clothes, and the neighbors cut it down because that was not acceptable. So what were some examples like that of things that you did not knowing that it wasn't acceptable?
Well, I think my so I'm a Midwesterner, and we know that Midwesterners, that we are aggressively friendly, right? We want to be helpful, and that's what we do. And it was very interesting because I think in the North, and I'm not sure that it's particularly Sami, but in the North you will have a lot of situations where it takes a lot longer to get to know people, and you're not overly helpful at first. That's approached with a bit of skepticism. But one of the other things that I thought was so interesting is the hellos and goodbyes, because as Midwesterners, I think we really do the protracted hello goodbye. Okay, bye, I'm leaving now. Okay, at the door, another little chat. Okay, bye. Okay, and then there's the driveway goodbye. There are like 17 layers to a Midwestern goodbye. And it's really true. But in Sami culture, you just silently slip out, even if you're leaving somebody's house, and you don't necessarily need to say anything. So the first time I was around my boyfriend's family and all the kids were around, I went around and was hugging all the children, saying goodbye to them, and they just looked horrified because to them they thought that I was either going to go die or never coming back again, because it was just so dramatic. Another good, just another funny example is just this. I think the way that some Americans, myself included, just am a little bit flippant in the way that I say I love you. Like, oh gosh, I love you. Thanks for doing that. It just means something different. And it slipped out of me. Somebody had given me a ride in the cold or something, and I said it was a man, and I said, oh gosh, I love you. Thank you. You saved me. Well, my female neighbor came down a few days later, and she was very quiet, came down and was drinking a cup of coffee, and I know she wanted to say something to me. And then I asked her, what do you have to say? And she said, Laura, when you are telling people thank you must not say you love them. Otherwise, all the men in this village will think you want to put your sock feet in the air. Put my sock feet in the air. So I learned my lesson,
I'm
because you know it's the
assuming,
Arctic, so it's your sock feet. It's not
yeah.
your legs in the air, it's your sock feet.
That is so clever. So you learned not to do that.
I never said I love you to another man unless I really did.
Now, what were some of the things that your new friends and family did that were surprising to you?
Oh, surprising to me. I don't. I think many things like the sense of time coming and going, you don't have a set schedule and you're not always punctual. And, when you're asking somebody to do something, you don't directly ask them. I think for me, it was sort of a, would you maybe think about, would you like to drive me on Friday to the market or something, like just little nuances in culture that you would never ever, really think about because they're not in guidebooks and they're everyday culture things. I'm
Would
trying to think
people
of.
stop by unannounced?
Yes, visitors would come and go all the time. And something very lovely about the way of visiting is just that you always have a pot of coffee going. People just come in. They don't even really need to knock necessarily, depending on how familiar you are with them. And people can just sit with you for hours and you don't have to have a discussion or even talk. And I didn't understand that because I've got the, you know, American Golden Retriever, let's chat about everything under the sun, we keep no silences. And that's just not really, it's about being present with someone. And I think there's something very lovely about that.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Laura Galloway, author of Dalvi, 6 Years in the Arctic Tundra.
I was wondering, you know, this reference to this pet psychic, that just blew me away.
Isn't it amazing?
Yes. Tell that story. Oh, that's fantastic.
Well, there's a man, I had never met this man, but there is a man in Atlanta called Tim Link, L-I-N-K, and he finds lost animals, and he finds them in remote regions. And he actually, my friend Tracy, who I write about in the book, suggested calling him because she had heard that he had expertise in finding animals that were in really remote places. And I had lost my cat, Boo, who I brought from New York City, on the tundra. He'd never been outside before. He was a shelter cat that I had adopted from Harlem. And one day in the spring, he got out the window and left. And I was absolutely devastated, and, you know, because you had rain and all sorts of weather, and he was gone for months. And I finally, Tracy said, you should just call this guy, because I'd tried everything else, and everybody was trying to help me find the cat. It really connected me to the community. But I called Tim Link, and he asks to see a picture of the animals. So he looked at a picture of Boo, and he told me that Boo was alive, and he described in perfect detail all of the places that were in my village, but from a cat's perspective. So he told me that he said he sees ATMs that were getting ready to leave. And, you know, and of course our village was chock-a-block with ATMs ATVs, not ATMs, no cash machines. I'm confusing my acronyms. Yeah, ATVs, and described just, and then sent me he asks about the general area where you are. And then he told me areas where Boo could be located. And then he told me that he was sending messages to Boo to come home. And right after, kind of after that happened, and everybody had been looking for him for months, Boo was found after about 3 months on the tundra. It was a long time, but this man had a connection to my cat. And I really believe this because when I was getting ready to move out of Norway, Boo ran away again, and he was gone for 2 days. He had not done that for years since he was lost the first time. And I contacted Tim Link because we were getting ready to go. And he said, I told me Boo is in a red house, 6 houses down from yours. It's very close, but I'm going to send him a message to come home right away. And within 5 minutes, Boo was meowing at the door.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, that is amazing.
He is amazing. He's amazing. Yes.
Gosh.
Wow. So, Laura, I was wondering, you know, you did this master's program in Indigenous journalism. Mm-hmm. Was there any pushback, the fact that you aren't Indigenous? You know, were there people who felt this wasn't an appropriate thing to do?
No, that's a great question, but no, because the program was geared towards people that were either Indigenous or that wanted to cover or understand the issues of Indigenous. So it was not, the program was not geared only to Indigenous journalists, but people that wanted to really know how to cover Indigenous issues, or they to write about them, or what have you.
Now, this book doesn't really deal with that so much, does it, with Indigenous issues?
No, it doesn't. It's very much, anyone that buys this book will see that it's been compared, although the stories are very different, to things like Eat, Pray, Love, and but without expensive vacations in Italy and gelato and Wild, just because it really, this story really, really is part of memoir. It goes very far back in time. The book goes back and forth to my childhood, which was pretty traumatic. And I had to write about that because that was really the catalyst for why I had been such a seeker my entire life.
Mm-hmm. And that So this memoir of your childhood, your young adulthood, you know, clear up to the time when you went, and then of course a lot more times detail and so forth of while you were there in Norway. But let's talk a little bit about childhood memoir and why you wanted to write that and how digging into that felt.
I wrote the memoir because I think I've said this many times, but I think that people that write memoirs want to make sense of their lives while they're still alive. And just, I think it's an excellent exercise in kind of understanding yourself, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And also for me, staying in Norway for me in a way was an act of defiance and not being a shrinking violet to say, I'm resilient, I can do this. I don't understand, I will make it work. But writing the memoir, the parts about my childhood and my family, that was also sort of an act of not cowering or being rejected, but asserting my own right to be myself. And I think growing up after my mother had died, my father remarried a woman that really didn't like any of his kids. And my brothers and my sister were pretty summarily sent away. My stepmother adopted me, but none of the other children. But I grew up not with, I didn't grow up with the suggestion that I wasn't really hers. I was constantly told, you're not my real daughter. You will have to watch your weight because you're not my real daughter. I was never, ever allowed to mention my mother, or told terrible things about her. I was growing up with a person that was battling a ghost. And I think when you're a little child and you grow up with that kind of abuse, you don't feel like you're worthy of telling your own story. There's something wrong with you and you're not allowed to be broken. And I write in my book about how things kind of came to a head for me in New York emotionally too. And I was very broken because I just felt like I could achieve my way out of any childhood trauma, and you can't. It comes back to you. So this was my way of just sort of, saying I have a right to have a story and I'm not perfect. Wow. And this is what happened.
Now, always when, writing memoir, there's sensitivity towards the people, other members of the family, and how they may perceive how you're writing it. How did you handle that?
Well, that was really hard, and it continues to be difficult. I changed, as I say in the beginning of the book, a bit of a disclaimer that I changed names and locations, except for where I came from, Indianapolis, and I tried to be as loving and full pictured as possible, but I just, I had to tell the story of my life. And in the end, I have a lot of compassion for everybody in my family. I don't think that anyone is particularly taken down in this memoir. And everybody is entitled to their own story and their own, But yes, it's hard. It's difficult. It's been, I think that my father and stepmother are quite old now, and I don't think that they're aware of the book, but I don't think they've read it or will read it. So,
and that is preferable in a way for you. But I found towards the end of the book, you do, talk about the peace that you made within yourself.
Yep.
About this. And, mm-hmm. And I found that very insightful.
Oh,
Do you
thank you.
think that without having gone to the Arctic, you would have ever come to that?
No, I think it would have taken much longer. I think I would have spent a lot, many more years probably just throwing other things at the hole that was inside of me, as opposed to being in the middle of nature, not having constant distractions that I think many of us have in regular life. It can be social media, it can be watching TV shows, it can be shopping, it can be binge eating, it can be drinking, it can be going to the gym, it can be working too much. I didn't have a lot of these distractions, and nature was incredibly healing to me because every day you're just out in nature walking, and it just that became a form of meditation for me. And I'm not somebody that was ever able to meditate, but that was kind of my meditation.
So in the middle of winter there, you still go outside and walk when it's so bitter cold?
Yes. Well, I think you all know about cold weather too.
Yes, yeah.
But I no, I mean I wasn't doing 11-mile hikes in minus 50, but for most of the year you're able to sort of spend time walking and being outside and just experiencing the nature and solitude, just solitude.
I wanted to ask you about the auroras. Now, I have heard of that, of course, but where does that come from, the auroras? I know
They're
they're
at,
the northern lights, but what are they?
yes. What are they? They're, oh boy, I can't give you the scientific explanation, but they're geomagnetic reflections in space. I'm sure that if you have any scientists listening to this, they're going to say, oh my gosh.
Well, that's
But
okay. That's okay. I mean,
they're very, very beautiful, and you can see them. Light pollution is the major consideration for seeing auroras next to having a very clear, cold sky. So October is actually an amazing time to see the auroras, and they're beautiful. And they tend to come out between 9 o'clock and 11 o'clock in night. That seems to be sort of the aurora hours when you're most likely to see them. And they are spectacular. And if you should never point at the auroras. I will say that's a Sami belief. That's, you just don't point at them. So if you're ever in the north, don't point at the auroras.
It's really nice that they come out at not in the middle of the night, but sometime when people can see them. I mean, that's pretty nice.
Yeah, they can come out much later too, but it just seems to be this 2-hour period that they're most regular, you can most regularly see them. And I actually put some, I have an Instagram account. It's author Laura Galloway, and I post a lot of the pictures of auroras from my time in Cauticano, that are pretty amazing.
Oh, wow. How long are the nights in the winter up there?
You have 24 hours of darkness at the darkest part of it, which and that is and also you have about another month or so where you just the days get shorter and shorter and shorter, and that's really so that's something interesting to try and deal with, complete pitch blackness, because you just don't want to. At 11 o'clock in the morning, you just don't know what to do with yourself. You
I
wonder if
can
you should go to
imagine.
bed, or I gained a lot of weight because you just want to cook hearty soups and breads and eat all the time, because it gives you a feeling of coziness. But the opposite of polar of this, like 24 hours of darkness is 24 hours of light, which I find to be much more unsettling, because people don't realize when you're trying to go to sleep, and this might be a very good tip for anyone that struggles with sleeping, you cannot just, you know, they tell you now, go into a darkened bedroom with no technology. Well, you have to settle into sleep, and light gradation is a really big part of it. So you can't just walk into a dark room and then lay down and go to sleep. And for me, that was really, really tough because you wouldn't have any kind of twilight that was switching your brain into sleep mode. And it was also strange because things in the summer are totally upside down. I lived in a village where it was very, very safe. And when it's sunny outside, you know, parents let their kids go. Kids will be riding their bikes at 2, 3, 4 in the morning.
Oh, my goodness.
and jumping on trampolines and things because you can. And it makes up for all the months that you're really stuck inside. But super unsettling.
Oh, wow. How long do like the 24 hour of dark and the 24 hour of light, how long does that last?
A little more than a month. And I won't tell you exactly because it feels like, because preceding and afterwards, you just have such little slivers of, of light and dark that it's almost negligible in terms of, you know, you don't get through the darkest day of the year and then the next day it gets better. It's just very, very gradual.
Oh my.
So, yeah. But 24 hours of light is the one thing that it was great for is that, as a woman alone with my dogs, just, I had no problem just in the summertime deciding to go camping and just going far, far out on the tundra with the dogs, and it never got dark. So that was, you know, you just felt no worries about that.
Oh, wow. So yeah. Tell us a little bit about your dogs, Laura.
So I have amazing dogs. If you hear a little whining, it's because Nilla, one of my dogs, is sitting at my leg. So I have Sammy reindeer herding dogs, and they, I got my first dog called Rasi, which means flower in Sammy, because I thought that she was generously given to me, but the girls aren't used as much in reindeer herding, and Rasi is white, which is not a good color for a reindeer herding dog that has to be seen over great distances. So I adopted Rasi and just totally in love with her. And then the mother got pregnant again and had another litter, and I adopted her little sister, Nilla. So Rasi and Nilla, again, I have millions of pictures. They're gorgeous dogs. Millions of pictures of them on my author, Laura Galloway, Instagram. But they're fabulous dogs.
Well, Laura, would you like to read from Dalvi, 6 years
sure.
in the Arctic Tundra? Great.
Sure. I'm going to read to you the first, just the first chapter. Nilla, settle down. Nilla the dog. So chapter one, Unraveled. Freezing cold and tired, I'm holding on to a long green tarp alongside a handful of others, guiding reindeer into an enormous holding enclosure in a remote part of the Norwegian Arctic. A giant buttery moon lies flat against the hard blue twilight sky, so low you feel as if you could easily touch it. It illuminates everything, from the jumpy reindeer moving en masse, a blinding flurry of hooves and poop and antlers, to my warm breath hitting the rimy cold night sky in plumes, like a smoker with a phantom cigarette. As I look up at the moon, toes numb and my muddy boots from having stood for what feels like hours waiting for herders to bring in the reindeer from the tundra, I am struck by the absolute insanity and marvel of life and of the improbable twists and turns in our stories that we could never begin to imagine. 1 year ago, a Saturday night would not have involved standing on the frozen expanse of the Finnmark Plateau with a family of Sami herders, watching steaming blood being scooped out of a reindeer carcass as it's field dressed by a grunting Sami man named Odd Hetta with a giant knife. 1 year ago, I would have been walking through Union Square in New York on my way to a progressively boozy dinner with friends, spending hours talking about their work and my media job, and did you read such and such in The New Yorker, and what show was on at MoMA, or what was happening in the increasingly worrying political landscape. And of course, there would have been talk of relationship problems, and there were always problems, or money problems, and how busy everyone was. And then the evening would have slowly unraveled, everyone growing louder and more maudlin, until it was over, a faded into a history of Saturdays just like every other one that came before it, followed by a sharp hangover the next day, a raft of emails, and stress and worries about everything, back in full view in an endless cycle. Those days were now far behind me, a distant memory of the person I was, tucked away like the dozens of utterly useless high-heeled shoes that sat with all my other earthly possessions in a storage area some 2,000 miles away in Manhattan, collecting dust and losing relevance. In my old life, tomorrow I would be heading to City Bakery for an iced coffee, with crippling anxiety about the Monday to come and how I would hang on one more day and a life that was becoming unmanageable to an extent of which no one around me was really aware, unless you happened to be the lucky recipient of a spectacular late-night Laura Galloway Ambien and red wine phone call. I was breaking up, open and falling apart, and to reveal this weakness and vulnerability to anyone might have caused me to die of shame. But the universe seemed to have plans for me, ones that would take me outside of everything I knew and everything that I thought made me me, to a place where I now think nothing of not showering for 3 days straight, and Saturday involves helping chop wood for a fence post or cutting reeds to dry and braid into shoes for the brittle winter to come, or smoking reindeer meat in a tent called a lavu while drinking bitter black coffee, the smoke clinging to my hair and clothing and settling into my pores. This is a place where you have to be with yourself because there are no distractions, only work and nature and time.
And that was Laura Galloway reading from Dalvi, 6 years in the Arctic Tundra. Laura, when did you start working on your book?
I started working on my book only after I had left living in the Arctic, and I had not intended to write a book when I had moved there.
Yeah, that was my next question.
No, I hadn't. And in fact, when I first moved to Norway, it was kind of at the height of everybody doing this immediate reporting on, you know, where they are and putting up Instagram pictures and doing blogs and things. And I learned very quickly, you know, that this was a really disingenuous way to approach living in the culture because I knew nothing about the culture and it would be ridiculous for me to. I had to have the experience of being there first. And I didn't know anything that I knew at the beginning of my journey that I knew at the end about myself, about how I fitted into the culture, anything. So I decided as I was leaving that I wanted to write about this experience, and I got a book contract, and I will tell you that the book was not picked up by any publishers in the United States. I have a very, very good agent, and it was turned down by almost every major publishing house. But in Europe, my British agents, I was able to get a book deal. So
you had a contract for it before you actually wrote it.
I did.
Which is unusual is this your first published book?
It's my first published book, but I did begin my career as a journalist. So I had writing, and also I had a unique story, and I wrote a very tight proposal and chapter outlines. And so it was, you know, you can't just send in – I'm sure all the writers know this already, so I'm just preaching to people that already understand. But you can't just sell an idea. It was a lot of work putting together the proposal and thinking out how the book would be structured and chapters and all of that.
But even so, I think it's fairly unusual to get a contract before writing a memoir as an unknown author.
Yes.
So congratulations for that.
Thank you.
When you decided you were going to write about this time, was it right at the beginning you said, okay, I'm going to write about this time, but I'm going to refer back to things in my past as well? This is really going to be kind of a a journey of self.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And did you, as you were writing, did you like, well, you said you did the chapter outlines. So you mm-hmm. knew before you really sat down to write that you were going to go back and forth between these two.
Right. Yes.
Yeah.
And to my, in my mind's eye, there was no way, there was no other way to do it because I had so much to tell about my growing up experience. And so it goes back and forth until the two sides meet in one chapter in the book. It just felt like the natural structure. And I don't think that I was talented enough to braid things in any other way.
The things about your childhood were just so very revealing, and but also it made me feel very sad for that little girl. But there was never a feeling of poor me that I got from you, in a way. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, thank
Which I think was was a challenge to do. You know, you write about it in a little bit of dispassionate way and yet in an emotive way also.
Well, thank you. I think that I didn't pour me it because with great difficulty come great gifts. And I think what I really realized when I had looked back through my entire life, in this book, just how many times there were incredible people that stepped into my life to keep me going, to champion me, to be supportive, mothers who are others, all sorts of people. And these were tremendous acts of love and kindness to me. And I feel so lucky to see that. And then I see how many of those people have been in my life. And I was just astonished.
And also you came to a great deal of empathy for the people who were not so kind and perhaps what they had been through.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, to me, that's kind of the heart of the matter.
Yeah, it felt important to try and come up with I think I came to the realization that, you know, that broken adults or people are always just trying to do their best, but people are, you know, coming at things with their own baggage and their own prior experiences and their own histories. And to always remember that. I think about my stepmother all the time. People say, oh, she's awful, you must hate her. I don't. I think of people that bother me and people like my stepmother, and I realized that some terrible things must have happened to her in order to have her sort of manifest into an adult who acted the way that she did. And if you imagine people as children, then it's much easier to have a lot of compassion for them.
I always try and remember when somebody is unkind or mean or cruel, it's like how unhappy they must be.
Right. And how separated they are from others. And, you know, it's a tragedy.
So, Laura, going back to your writing of the book, what does your writing process look like?
Well, I have an amazing had an amazing editor in the UK for my book and a very good relationship with her. And I think for anybody that gets a book contract, you know, I went to several meetings in England with potential editors and book publishers that made offers here. And I picked the person that I felt I would work the best with, who kind of felt like a friend. And my process was, when you have a contract, then you have to write the book. and I know myself, you should know yourself. And that is, I knew that in high school, for example, I was the kind of person that would wait until the 11th hour to bang out a paper. It's why I loved deadline writing when I was, you know, doing reporting work a million years ago at the LA Times. And so I wrote a chapter a week. That would be my assignment. It was to get a whole chapter done. I would send it to Claire, my editor, every Friday, and it just kept me paced. That was my job. You got to get it done. And move through it and butt in seat, and you can't sit and wait for inspiration to strike. It's just not how it works.
Wow. Do you do a lot of self-editing as you write?
I do. What I would also do is read chapters out loud to Jonathan, my partner, to whom the book is dedicated, and sort of, I think, giving things what I call a table read, like they do in the movie, sort of, that really helps. And that was very, very helpful to the editing process for me, because then you hear when you're reusing words over and over. And, but you know, the editing process is so important in a book, because you just need fresh eyes. As good as you think you are, you need fresh eyes. And I'm lucky that one of my best friends is one of the most astonishingly good editors ever. Her name's Molly, and she used to be a reporter at the Toledo Blade, and she just had endless patience with looking at copies of, you know, the book, and was really helpful.
Just amazing to me that you were able to get through your difficult childhood and family difficulties and progress into this woman that's woman of the world. Absolutely woman of the world.
Oh, thank you.
So, Laura, did you keep a journal while you were in the Arctic?
Yes and no. Yes, I kept a personal journal. But the other thing that I did was I think this is a really great way for any writer to kind of keep details. And I would send myself, just put in the subject, you know, create whatever subject you want. But I would, you know, book notes or something. But even before I knew that I was writing a book, I just wrote notes on Kauto, like notes on Kautokeino, things that I knew that I wanted to remember that I would forget, including mundane stuff. I would just email myself things, and I did it in Gmail, and then you can look at notes you took. And then I remembered all sorts of details that otherwise would have just escaped me. Like, I remember when my neighbor came down, and I directly wrote down after she said the thing about putting your sock feet in the air, I thought that was the most hilarious thing I'd ever heard. So I said, I have to remember every detail of this because I'll never stop laughing. So things like that you remember. Or, you know, I taught in the reindeer herding high school, and I kept my notes from teaching, and all sorts of stuff.
What is a reindeer herding high school?
So in Kautokeino, there is actually a high school, and it's a Sami high school, and there are many kids that will go on to university, but they also have, you know, indigenous knowledge courses, and it's, you know, Sami language, of course, but there's also, you know, a set of courses for reindeer herders, which is really, really important. It sounds like it should be a Netflix limited TV series musical, but it's the reindeer herders have to learn a lot of stuff, and they need to learn about the environment. They need to learn about what are the bigger governmental laws and how to navigate things with reindeer herding. They're young kids who might have grown up reindeer herding, but they need to learn stuff that makes that lifestyle possible. So the economics of reindeer herding, if you know how you get, how can I afford the snowmobile? What equipment do I need? How much, you know, they have to learn all of these things. In animal husbandry, they learn, you know, they work with established herders. And the other really interesting thing is they have a totally different school schedule, which is based, because reindeer herding is based on nature. And so they don't come in every day. They'll have months where they will come into school, or 3 weeks on, or, you know, so that's what the reindeer herders have, their own curriculum.
So is reindeer herding still a vital part of the economy there, is tourism a major aspect of it?
Tourism is not so major, but it's increasing. Not all Sami people are reindeer herders. I lived around reindeer herding Samis, and that's about 10% of Sami population. You have sea Samis who would do fishing and, you know, all sorts of things. But it is still an important source of livelihood in these villages of Karashok and Kautokeino. But increasingly it's a indigenous livelihood that is constantly challenged, because the primary requirement for reindeer herding is land. And there's competition in Norway for what you do with the land. It's competition against building wind farms or mining. I mean, this is a very, very mineral-rich part of the world. And now you have the whole Arctic melting because of global warming. And so everybody is jockeying to take over the Arctic. And will there be a railroad going into the Arctic? Because it's, you know, and just all sorts of stuff to that are challenging having this, you know, indigenous way of, you know, doing traditional reindeer herding, and you need land.
I was going to ask if the Norwegian government is supportive of the Samis, or, you know, how they feel about that.
It's a constant battle between the oversight is with Norwegian government, and there's a huge always multiple conflicts in Sweden and Norway about reindeer herding rights versus states' rights in terms of, and unfortunately in most cases, you know, as much as we want to talk about environment and global warming and everything, most decisions in most countries are made based on money. How much money are we going to make, as opposed to how much land are we going to save? So commerce almost always trumps ecology.
So Laura, are there some specific indigenous issues that you intend to write about next?
Probably not. I feel like if I could have one dream for my time, the time living in the North, is I would really like to see major news organizations commit to hiring actual indigenous people to cover their own issues. Because I think you can't have outsiders cover it. My language is not good enough to do it. And I feel like we're living in a world now where we're increasingly having more diversity of voices, and I would love to see news organizations hiring more indigenous journalists to cover things like this, and as well as commit more space to those issues.
Well, thank you. We're out of time, but this has been just a pleasure. Your book is so interesting, and you know, it's a great story. You know, it's a story of your life, but it's a great story. And I want to thank you for being with us today.
Thank you both so much. It was really a pleasure.
And Caroline, do you have some final words for us?
Well, I had quite a few, but actually, because she found so many wonderful friends, I just want to say this, that we all know that friends are the family that we choose.
That's right, Caroline. That's absolutely right.
Well, thank you, and see you all next week on Writer's Voices.
Goodbye.
Bye, everybody.
Bye. Thank you.